The Mickey Miles Podcast is brought to you by MEI Travel and Mouse Fan Travel, who will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own, bringing premium service and expert advice to help you get the most out of your vacation dollar. Visit them at MEI-travel.com or mousefantravel.com.
Hi, this is Amy from South Dakota, and I love the Mickey Miles Podcast.
This is the Mickey Miles and More Podcast. Your one stop for information on Disney races, Disney vacations, Disney theme parks, and more. Now, here are your hosts for the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, Michelle Scribner-McLean, Chris Eliopoulos, and Mike Scopa.
Welcome to episode 360 of the Mickey Miles and More Podcast. This is Mike Scopa. Well, folks, this is our third and final installment of our visit with Disney historian Jim Corcus. We all hope that you've enjoyed the past two episodes, and we finish off with even some more interesting information from Jim. So sit back and enjoy. Jim, I wonder, one of the things that I remember hearing a long time ago was that the carousel is not actually technically in the spot that it originally was. And that's because Roy Disney...
Mike, you are absolutely wonderful. You're absolutely wonderful to set me up with that as well. Yes, what happened is when the Magic Kingdom was being built, Roy Disney, and we really need to get together and do a show on Roy Disney.
Yes.
Because,
yes.
You know...
You're already invited.
The story of Walt Disney World is not just the story of Walt Disney. It's the story of two brothers and the love of two brothers. But Roy was standing at the train station, and he was looking down Main Street, and he looked, because they were putting the carousel in, and he said, "Nope, it's off center." And they said, "No, well, no, Mr. Disney, it's an optical illusion, you know, and you know, it's expensive." And he said, "Nope, it's got to be centered." And so they went and they measured, and sure enough, it was off like by a foot or two.
Ah.
And so they, despite
the
expense,
don't mess with a Disney.
despite the expense, they moved it into the right location. And again, it was Roy's philosophy and Walt's as well. If you're going to do something, do it right, and do it right the first time. You know, and people will notice. And in fact, all of us notice for a different reason. You know, have you ever stood in Town Square and looked down and it looks like, my gosh, it's forever to get to that castle?
Yes.
There's several reasons for that. First off, Main Street rises about 6 feet before you get to the castle, but it raises very gradually. And the vanishing point, you know, those things you did as a kid where the railroad tracks or the road or, you know, whatever would disappear to one particular point. The vanishing point you're looking at is not the end of Main Street. It's not even the castle. You're looking through the castle at the carousel. So it seems so much longer to walk up the street because Walt and Roy wanted you to take your time, you know, to become immersed in this experience. Now, at the end of the day, when you've got a crying kid or your feet hurt or whatever, you're standing there by the castle, you're looking down, it looks so much shorter because the vanishing point is not the train station, it's the flagpole.
Ah.
And again, it's also downhill.
That's right.
So you know, one of the questions when I worked at Disney, and one of the roles I had was working at the Disney Institute and the Disney University, so you'd have these big companies come in, you know, how does Disney do this? And one of the questions I would get was, you know, how does Disney control all these people? And I said, honestly, Disney does not control the people. Oh, yeah. Ha, ha, ha. Very funny. I said, no, they control the experience. They said, what do you mean by that? I said, take a look at Cinderella's castle, and what do you not see happening? And again, they're all stunned, And I do that again just to show off. And I said, take a look at the railings. The railings have these little crenellations. Crenellations are those little bumps. And they measured the bumps so they are smaller. The gap is smaller than a child's rear end. So if a child decided to sit up on that railing, it would be poking in an unfortunate place. So basically, now you don't have to have cast members out there as bullies going, please get off the railings. You don't have to have all of this signage that conflicts with Cinderella's castle saying, stay off the railings. People are controlling themselves. Mm. There's also a slant to the railings. You'll notice that on the bridge heading over to Liberty Square. The railing on the bridge doesn't have crenellations, but it's slanted so that if you try to jump up on the railing, you're going to slide back down to the bridge.
Wow.
And it's also lacquered to make sure that those things happen. As you come into the hub, most people are right-handed. And so the entrance to Tomorrowland is three times the size of the entrance of Adventureland, which is on your left.
Ah.
Because most people are going right. You're controlling the experience. You're not controlling the people.
I got to tell that to Sam Genoway.
I've talked to Sam about that. Sam is wonderful, and I love his book. So those of you who are listening and are going to go to Amazon.com and look up Jim Korkis, K-O-R-K-I-S, and Vault of Walt, take a look at Sam Genoway and the books that he's written, because he writes from such a unique perspective as an urban planner. So it's not just a Disney fan going, oh, this is just so wonderful. It's an urban planner that goes, look at the choices that they made, and this just helps, you know, the flow of the crowd and makes things just so much more convenient for so many people.
We actually just had Sam on the show a few weeks ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He said the same thing about you, Jim. I have another sort of a...
Now I've got to send the $20 that you're going to send to me to Sam.
Well, split it.
Gosh darn it.
Split it. So,
I was going to buy a book. All right.
Here's another lead. You ready for this one? So let's talk about... I want you to just comment on two things. Number one, this carousel originally held 72 horses. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And then when it was moved out... here, I keep saying we as if I still work for Disney. Disney wanted to accommodate more people, and so on the carousel were two chariots. Chariots are like those benches, those elaborate benches that are on there. So they removed the two chariots and got horses from, hand-carved horses from another classic carousel, because as I said, oftentimes those are sold individually. And so it was boosted up to 92 horses. And then, excitingly, before Isle left the company, she had been searching for the original chariots, because Disney, stores these things, but they store them in huge warehouses. There are warehouses down here in Florida, but also out in California, and they don't belong to Disney, the items in there. They belong to the individual department. So if you went inside and you saw something you wanted, you couldn't just say, well, Disney owns this. I want this in my area. You have to purchase it from that department.
Oh, wow.
And so Isle had photos of the chariots, and as people have gotten older, and because there's mobility issues for some people, they thought, gosh, it'd be nice if we had the chariots back on there so that people could sit, and while their kids or family were on the horses, they were enjoying the same experience. Nobody could find the chariots, and so they searched all the warehouses out here in Florida, couldn't find them, whatever. And this went on for at least 10 years, and a friend of Isles was out in California on a project and just happened to be in a warehouse and was walking through this huge warehouse. So it looks like the warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, except with more shelves. And for some reason, he just felt he should stop, and he looked over his shoulder up in the air, and there was one of the chariots. And it was unmarked, and so, you know, it wasn't on the books. And he took a picture. He sent it to Isle. Isle said, that's the one. They took it down. Isle and John Hench rehabbed the chariot, and then it got installed on the carousel. So now there's something like 84 horses on there now. And I said, well, Isle, you found this. Now you can make, you know, a fiberglass mold and you know, put... And she looked at me, and she wagged her finger, and she said, only the originals. And interestingly enough, the horses on the Walt Disney World carousel, they made fiberglass molds of them there on the carousel over at Disneyland Paris. The outer ring is hand-carved horses, but all of the inner ring, you know, the B, C, D, E, are fiberglass molds from the carousel at Walt Disney World, because they were just so magnificent, and they were not able to find anything that could match that. But Mike, you had another question.
Well, I was going to say, but none of those horses that you just mentioned has the nickname Jingles, right?
No, Jingles is the name of a horse for the King Arthur Carousel out in California at Disneyland. And Saving Mr. Banks, which I think is a wonderful film, and I think captures the true spirit of what was actually happening, is not factually accurate. Walt never took P.L. Travers to Disneyland. On the day that he was supposed to take her to Disneyland, Walt had a terrible sinus problem that a lot of people don't realize, you know, besides the polo injury and all that, but it was so intense that it would, you know, go to his jaw and all that, and so he wasn't able to do that. So he sent a publicity person to take P.L. Travers to Disneyland. But in the movie, she rides Jingles, who is supposedly, he and his wife's favorite horse. There's no documentation of that whatsoever. However, that horse did get rededicated as the Julie Andrews horse, the Mary Poppins horse. And so, there's a little flying Mary Poppins on the saddle and all of that. But, yes, Jingles is now officially called Jingles. Again, it was a cast member type thing, calling it Jingles because there was a belt on the bridle there, and but now it officially got dedicated to Julie Andrews. It's the Julie Andrews Jingle Horse now, so that is legitimate. Go enjoy that, and as I said, that is a carousel that again is an authentic carousel that was purchased for Disneyland.
You know, Jim, one of my jobs is to train teachers, and one of the things I always tell them is that even if you don't like a topic, if you sound passionate about it, mm-hmm. the kids will be interested. And you are I know you do like this topic. You are so passionate. I think I could just listen to you for hours. It's so interesting.
Well, really? Well, you know, I had one young lady say, you know, I wish I could just fall asleep listening to the sound of your voice. And I said, you know, I was a junior high school teacher. I had many kids who did that.
But you weren't teaching about this stuff.
No. As a junior high school teacher, this was out in Southern California. I taught English and drama and speech, but. In my English class, I would also talk about Bigfoot and UFOs and all of that. You know, if you're going to diagram a sentence, sometimes it's more interesting if Bigfoot is walking through that sentence there.
I think Mike would agree with that.
and you can do that. And, you know, Walt, of course, loved education. And he said, you know, if you make it fun, if you make it exciting, kids will be open to learning.
I have a question for you on your book. You know, you're talking about how you're telling people how to be the, you know, next Disney historian. But I think to relate it to people and make people want to listen to you, you have to be a storyteller as you are. I mean, do you have any advice for people in doing that? I mean,
Yes. You have to realize that whatever story you're telling, it's about people. And for me, that eye-opening moment was I went to Glendale Junior College, and then I transferred to Occidental, where I got my BA and my MA. But at Glendale Junior College, I had to take a class to fulfill a requirement, and I wanted to pick a class that was close to my other classes so that, you know, I could get them all out of the way, as opposed to I do this and then I have to go away and come back, you know, and do another class. And so I took a class on Civil War history simply because it was the right time slot and, you know, fill a history requirement. And it was taught by a Civil War historian. And I had no idea what a Civil War historian was. And, you know, I'd been told that, yeah, he's called out to consult, and he had consulted on a mural at Forest Lawn Memorial Park or whatever. And I thought, you know, how hard is this class going to be? I know the Civil War. I know who won, you know? I've seen movies, you know? I know this. And I was just enthralled in that class because he brought up the fact that, you know, it's about people. And he would bring in these little side stories like they were condiments, you know, to that. And he said, well, and of course, he started one class by, he said, and in the Civil War, of course, you know, that's where the term hooker began. We go, what does this have to do with Robert E. Lee and all of it? Apparently, there was a Union general called General Hooker, and he allowed women to follow his camp from place to place, and so the women could, you know, take care of the soldiers, and so they became known as Hooker's women. And from that, and take a look at the sound where you're going, and you're making that connection, and now suddenly this is not just names and dates, you know, or even an event. Suddenly this now becomes, oh my gosh, you know, it's human, it's alive. And so those of you who are interested in being Disney historians, it's important to have the accurate information, but who are the people behind that information? What was happening? Yes, we know that Walt Disney was, you know, in New York when he was working on Steamboat Willie, but do you realize that every night on hotel stationery, he would send a love letter to Lillian about how much he missed her, how much he missed her cooking, you know, And in fact, Dave Smith pitched to Disney Editions, because they have all of this correspondence between Walt and Lillian, to do a book of love letters between Walt and Lillian while Walt was struggling, you know, to get Steamboat Willie finished. And Disney Edition said, no, that's just a niche market. People wouldn't be interested in that.
Aww.
I know. That's the reaction that I had. I think that's what makes Disney history or any history come alive, are those little personal bits where these are people and the little struggles and little, and I think that enriches the overall picture. So yes, in the book that's coming out, How to Be a Disney Historian, we talk about that. I hope this book is going to be of value to people beyond Disney history. But again, all of the examples are Disney in the book. There's a chapter on plagiarism. There's a chapter on how to do interviews, with older folks who may not quite remember. You know, I've run into that many times. And then how do you deal with it when somebody tells you something that you know is absolutely wrong? You know, I just interviewed a Disney legend who worked on It's a Small World, and he told me Alice Davis had nothing to do with the costumes. And I said, no, I think Alice worked on the costumes of It's a Small World. And I said, I think there's documentation or anything. No, I was there. She wasn't involved at all. So how do you handle something like that? You know, and how do you get, how do you ask questions that are going to open people up to talking? You know, if I say, do you like chocolate? And you say, yes, that doesn't help me at all. I need to ask a question where you're going to say, yes, I love chocolate, and that reminds me of the time when I such and such and such and such. So when we're telling Disney history, I think it's so exciting. It's so wonderful. And what's so exciting and so wonderful is there were mistakes all the time. Walt made mistakes all the time. He had more hits than misses, you know. But that's the fascinating thing is, oh, my gosh, why did they make that choice? Why did they do this? Why did they go in this direction? And, you know, I think we're living at a wonderful time where there's a lot of books out there. You know, Theme Park Press just released books with Tom about Tom Nabby and about Sully Sullivan, who's such a great character, you know, so that material is going to be out there. One of the things that should be in everybody's library is the Walt's People series, started by Didier Getz. There's 18 volumes now, and each book has interviews with people who worked with Walt and worked at Disney. And so Didier went to many different Disney historians, including myself, and said, you interviewed these people. Can we share this interview so that other people can make use of these? And I said, sure. And, you know, one of these days, 100 years from now, they'll go and they'll go, you know, on that Mickey Miles podcast that they did with that Corkin guy, you know.
Well, all I can say is that I'm kind of excited because how many Disney podcasts can push an episode and say, come listen to Jim Corkus talk about the Prince Charming Regal Carousel and hookers.
And again, I know you have a wide audience, so I tried to be
is it
gentle.
That wide?
But it was that that was one of the insights that just, you know, stood out for me. I guess I could have pulled one about one of the generals that had false teeth, and so, you know, he was so irritated that's why a battle actually happened. Because his teeth didn't fit well, you know. It's just a wonderful world, and we need to enjoy it. But as I tell people too, remember that there is more to life than Disney. Make sure you pay your rent before you buy that extra pair of, you know, glow in the dark ears, and talk to other people about things beyond Disney, you know, and get yourself other hobbies. You realize that that Dave Smith collects Civil War autographs.
Wow, that's going to be tough to do these days.
and so, you know, if you find those other little things to do when you come back to Disney, that's just going to enrich it. Mm-hmm. You're just going to feel. I tell people, go to Universal, go to SeaWorld, all of that.
What?
Because, you know, that's a wonderful
wow.
experience. But once you do that, and then you come back to Disney, you see there's no comparison.
Right. Yeah. It gets so judging.
And there's no comparison to having Jim Corkus on. And we want you to come back, Jim. We've got so many more episodes ahead that we would love to have you come and talk about Roy Disney. We want you to talk about your books, of course, when the book comes out.
And we've got Walt Disney World's anniversary coming up here in October.
That's true. And we still have to hear your stories of when you were Merlin and, of course, Pat, right? Pat the Prospector.
Right, Prospector Pat, Noel Goldman. And it had to be Prospector Pat because they already had a convention character called Prospector Pete, gosh darn it. And so I was in the Diamond Grand Horseshoe Review doing some of this stuff. And I had a little raccoon puppet. and it had a spring inside so that it looked like it was moving up and down my arm, and it could wiggle its nose, and it could jump at a guest.
Wow.
Yes. Right, so, dinner, so right? You know, lots of stories. So, again, you guys are so fun. You are obviously... Walt would be so proud of all of you that, you know, you are such great models for the Disney fan community.
Well, you know, one of the things, maybe this before we say goodbye, we want mm-hmm. to mention that sometime this year we hope to have the ghost of Walt Disney on.
That would certainly be interesting.
That's a little bit of a tease. But, Jim, we want to thank you for coming on, and we'll look forward to bringing you on in the future.
Thank you so much. And for the listeners, remember, go to Amazon.com or ThemeParkPress.com, and you'll have more Jim Korkus than you know what to deal with.
And you won't be, and I'll tell you, there's just so much information. I've read the Vault of Walt at least three times because I just love those stories, and you're a great storyteller, Jim. So once again, thank you for coming on.
And thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
So, well, Michelle, did you want to say anything?
No, just thank you. It was wonderful.
Well, I want to thank, for Eve Vanderpool and for Chris Aliopoulos and for Michelle Scribner-McLean, this is Mike Scopa and for Jim Korkus saying we'll see you on the road and in the parks.
The Mickey Miles Podcast is brought to you by MEI Travel and Mouse Fan Travel, who will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own, bringing premium service and expert advice to help you get the most out of your vacation dollar. Visit them at mei-travel.com or mousefantravel.com.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode of the Mickey Miles and More podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to mickeymiles.podbean.com and click the green Become a Patron button in the upper right-hand corner of the menu bar. We thank you for your support. Don't forget, our discussion continues on Facebook at facebook.com/Mickey Miles Podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/Mickey Miles Pod. Last of all, don't forget, if you have any questions for us, you can send them to questions@MickeyMilesPodcast.com, and we'll try to answer them as soon as possible. For all of us here at the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, this is Rick Gregg saying thanks for listening and all your support. And until next time, we'll see you on the road.